Let's go save Nevada and go save America.
Republicans hope the path to a Senate majority goes through Nevada. It's Friday, October 28th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later in the show, we'll hear how some states are providing for kids after the federal government ended its pandemic-era free lunch program. And we take a canoe ride down the Milwaukee River in search of beavers. But first, this morning an intruder broke into the San Francisco home of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and assaulted her husband, reportedly shouting, "Where is Nancy?" The attack comes at a time of intense partisan fights over election security, just ahead of the November 8th midterms. Today, our weekly politics roundtable checks in on two key states, Ohio and Nevada. Celeste Headley and Deepa Fernandez called up Henry Gomez, senior national political reporter for NBC, who's based in Cleveland, and Elizabeth Thompson, editor of the Nevada Independent. Here's their conversation.
So I want to start by getting your reaction to the news of this attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband. We are still learning about what the motive may have been, but we should point out, "Where is Nancy?" is the same thing many rioters were shouting in the halls of the Capitol during the January 6th insurrection. So, Henry, you're in Ohio. Have you seen evidence of political animosity that has maybe evolved into violence?
Not so much that's manifested itself in direct violence, but I live right outside the congressional district of Anthony Gonzalez, the Republican congressman who voted to impeach Donald Trump after January 6th. And Gonzalez opted not to seek re-election this year because of threats he said that he and his family had received. And it's really just part of a growing and disturbing trend of threats of violence and other menacing nature against sitting office holders and their families, really. You know, their addresses are public record. People find out where they live or they find out where their offices are, and they make threats about how they can access them. And it's a whole, I mean, it's always been there, but it's really intensified after January 6th.
Elizabeth, what have you seen in Nevada? I should mention a local public official was arrested in September on charges of murder, murdering a local journalist.
Yeah, that was disturbing, to say the least, and an ongoing story here in Nevada. That was a Clark County employee who is now facing murder charges. I think the most obvious and disturbing example in Nevada was last February. Our governor, Governor Sisolak, and his wife were out to for a meal at a local restaurant. A gentleman approached them with a phone, asked to take a selfie type of photo, but the situation very quickly turned bad. This gentleman started yelling at the governor and his wife. I won't repeat all of the heinous things that were said, but one of them was that the governor should be strung up by a lamppost. There was a racial slur directed at his wife, Kathy, who's of Asian descent. And this gentleman verbally accosted the governor, and it went on and on, followed the governor out into the parking lot, screaming at him and recording the whole thing on his phone. So the video ended up going public the next day in the media here. So that's the one that sticks in my mind the most, because that was a fairly disturbing situation that could have gone badly awry.
I mean, it's an incredibly charged environment in which to be having an election right now. And Elizabeth, the Nevada Supreme Court last night halted a hand count of ballots that have been cast in Nye County, which is a very conservative part of your state, with just 40,000 registered voters. You know, it's also the epicenter of a movement to count ballots by hand. So what happened last night, and what does it mean?
Well, the reason the Secretary of State petitioned the high court to cease the hand counting is that confidential ballot information was being read out loud from one poll volunteer to the next, and that's illegal. You cannot broadcast or telecast voter information out loud audibly in a
right. They
in
even
a
wanted
to
live stream it. They wanted to live stream it.
Yeah,
right?
So I mean, it's, I hate to laugh, but it's just gotten to the point of being so astounding that there's almost no other reaction to have, where this county that Trump won by 70% is, the commissioners are convinced that voter fraud is a problem. So yes, they are trying to do a hand count. They probably can get away with doing a hand count if they cease reading ballot information out loud. That itself is not illegal. We'll have to see how the high court rules. But another thing I want to mention.
We should point out, just very quickly, point out that, you know, that the hand counting of ballots is because they say that electronic voting machines are vulnerable to fraud, yet voting experts say that hand counting takes longer and is less accurate. You know, I'm just wondering where you think this will fall, because we're not at election day yet.
Yeah, well, the test, their test of the hand counting of only 50 ballots took hours. And so there's now a concern that, look, if you want to hand count 20,000 ballots, and let's say you even speed your pace up by 100% or twice that, you're still probably only going to be able to count maybe 10,000 ballots a week, which means it would be weeks in Nye County before we would have results. So that's one concern. But whether that's illegal or not, I think the high court will have to rule there. I want to just add real quick that one of the other things we've seen here in Nevada, it's not just Nye County. 6 of 17 county clerks have resigned in the last year because of harassment and threats of violence and the job just becoming too stressful and too worrisome. So we're going to have county clerks and roughly a third of Nevada's counties administrating elections who have never done so before in the upcoming.
So, Henry, in Ohio, we have a Senate candidate, a Republican, J.D. Vance, who has cast doubt repeatedly on the results of the 2020 election. He was once a Trump critic, but has since been endorsed by Trump in his race against the Democrat, Congressman Tim Ryan. In a recent TV interview with WLWT, Vance was asked about what he would tell voters about why he changed his mind on the former president.
Would you rather have a guy who's honest about, you know, making a mistake about changing their mind? Or would you rather have a guy like Tim Ryan who supported a lot of really bad policies for this state?
So much of what Elizabeth has been talking about relates back to the last election. Do you think Trump support is helping or hurting Vance?
You know, I think it's helping him. This is a state, Ohio, that Trump won twice by about 8 percentage points. If Vance had a problem in the primary, which was really crowded and really nasty, it was his past comments that were critical of Trump that a lot of his opponents and the outside groups backing them spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars to remind voters of. So he won by a plurality, and it was, you know, certainly aided by Trump's endorsement. And now that he's out of that primary, you know, you are seeing some Democratic groups who are actually trying to call attention to that past criticism, cast Vance as a phony, maybe sow some doubt into the mind of base Republican voters that he hasn't always been with Trump. But, you know, it's in a state where Trump is still very popular, certainly more popular than President Biden, a state that's been trending red, it can help. And Trump is coming back on election eve, the night before the election, to do a rally with J.D. Vance. Mm. Certainly they see this as being a successful formula. It's the one thing Vance has that sort of connects him to Ohio, because one of the things the Ryan campaign has been arguing is that he's sort of this interloper, carpetbagger, even though he grew up here, he moved away to Silicon Valley to be a venture capitalist. So, you know, having that Trump seal of approval is something that can help rally the base around him in a state where you need that to win.
And that's exactly what the Democrat, Tim Ryan, is going at, that Vance is a venture capitalist and very out of touch with working class voters in Ohio. Let's listen to some of that interview on WWT.
I've had the guts to take on my own party. I ran against Nancy Pelosi. I've gotten in fights with Bernie Sanders. I take on Democrats when I think they're wrong. And I will agree with Republicans when I think they're right.
But his party seems to have largely left him to fend for himself. Why, Henry?
Well, you know, it's the 8 percentage point data point that I mentioned. The national Democrats I talk to are very skeptical that Ohio is going to swing back blue this year. You know, when I talk to them, they say, you know, fool me once, you know, shame on you. And that refers to 2016 when they all thought Hillary Clinton was going to win Ohio. But then the polls leading up to 2020 showed Joe Biden within the margin of error in Ohio. And he lost by the same 8 points that Hillary Clinton did. So they feel as if, you know, there are polling issues here that undercount rural voters who come out and benefit the Republicans. And they're looking to spend their money in more competitive states, states that are important where you have to, you know, prop up incumbents who need it, like in Georgia and Arizona and Nevada. Yeah. And, you know, if they're going to do a reach, they're going to reach for a place like North Carolina where they feel the demographics are more consistent with their party.
That's Henry Gomez. He's senior national political reporter for NBC News based in Cleveland. Elizabeth Thompson is editor of the Nevada Independent. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Next month, voters will also decide more than 100 ballot measures in 37 states. One of them in Colorado asks whether the state should guarantee free school lunches.
School nutrition directors in Colorado reported that during the pandemic, free school meal participation grew by 20 to 40%.
More on that after the break. It's been nearly a month since the federal government's universal free school lunch program expired. The program provided free school lunches to more than 50 million public school students nationwide during the pandemic, but will now only pay for children in the lowest income families. And some states are scrambling to fill the void. In Colorado, voters will decide whether to reinstate the program with state money. Deepa spoke with Colorado Public Radio reporter John Daly, who's been covering the story.
So families have spent this last month scrambling to make sure their children have lunch because this program ended. What's that looked like in Colorado?
During the pandemic, federal waivers allowed all students to access free meals, but those waivers expired this fall, and school nutrition directors in Colorado reported that during the pandemic, free school meal participation grew by 20 to 40%. So we know that a lot of families were relying on this program.
And quickly, let's just spell out that pre-pandemic, to qualify for a free school lunch, your family had to be below a certain income level, and that was guided by federal poverty data. But if you were just above that, which means you may not be making a lot of money, in fact, you're probably not that much better off, your children did not qualify for free lunch.
That's exactly right. And in Colorado, that number is estimated to be more than 60,000 kids.
That's a lot of kids. So you've been speaking to some families. How have they been coping?
I think they've been doing their best. They're scrambling, too. When a government program ends that the family's been relying on, they've got to adjust. And it simply means that those families got to do something else for those meals.
And so there is a ballot initiative in Colorado to bring back universal free school lunch. It's called Healthy School Meals for All. It's Prop FF. If you're in Colorado, keep your eye out for it. How would it work and who pays for it?
Yeah, if voters okay this, it would create a program and a sustainable long-term funding source to offer free meals for all public school students and help schools to pay for them. It would also pay for increases for frontline school cafeteria workers, which helps schools dealing with staff shortages, and it would incentivize schools to buy Colorado products. And to pay for it, the measure would raise $100 million a year. It would do that by increasing state taxable income, but just for the richest Coloradans, for the 3 or 4% who make at least $300,000 a year.
So literally, the rich would be paying for school lunches for all kids.
Exactly.
And I guess that, you know, brings some critics forth because they don't want their taxes raised. What are they saying about Prop FF? Is there pushback? Is there an opposition to this?
There's no organized opposition, but there are some groups that put out voter guides that are advising a no vote. They criticize the total cost and the funding mechanism for this. A lot of kids do already qualify for free school meals and are already getting them, but proponents as we were saying before, you know, they say that's not an insignificant number, that 60,000 figure. So they say a lot of people would benefit if this passes. So it's really kind of a political, philosophical difference, I think, that you're seeing here.
Hmm. And I wonder if there are people saying, well, why should we pay for school lunches for kids from upper middle class families? They can afford their own lunch.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what they're saying. And I think the proponents respond to that to say, hey, everybody needs the access to a good meal. Some families may choose not to go that route, or their kids may bring lunch or go off campus if they're in high school and get a lunch elsewhere. But at least the lunch should be available to everybody.
So in California and Maine, the legislature saw this coming and passed legislation to extend the free lunch to everybody. Why do you think Colorado went the ballot route?
In Colorado, lawmakers were considering this during the last legislative session and then decided to refer it to the voters to put it on the ballot this fall.
And any sense how the people of Colorado feel about this? Do you think it'll pass?
Well, you know, the backers of the measure say there is broad support for this and that they have internal polls to back it up. I'm not aware of any statewide polling by a news organization on it. Most parents I've spoke to agree that there's definitely a need. They'd like all kids to be properly fed. Not all of them see this as the best way to fund it. Also, traditionally in Colorado, tax increases have been a tough sell for Colorado voters, unless it's directed at so-called sin taxes, you know, things like marijuana or gambling. So it'll be up to the voters to see what happens here.
John Daly is a health reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up next, beavers are back in downtown Milwaukee, but they're a little elusive. I went out to find one last time I was there and managed not to drop my recording equipment into the river. Stick around. I was up in Milwaukee a few weeks back before it got cold, and I wanted to check in on some longtime residents of the region that have been making a comeback lately. Beavers. The American beaver was once a fixture of this area, at the confluence of three rivers by the shores of Lake Michigan. Then the region's first European residents made Milwaukee one of their main fur trading posts, hunting and trapping beavers for their pelts, and the population plummeted. As the city developed, people turned marshes into industrial land and pumped pollution into the rivers, and North America's largest rodent was all but evicted from Milwaukee. But a few years ago, people started noticing trees along the riverbanks in the heart of downtown Milwaukee that had been gnawed down to a point. Only a beaver could do that.
Without a paddle!
Researchers have been spotting beavers in Riverside Park, a few miles north of downtown, for a few years. And it's a convenient place to learn about the animals, too, because it's also home to the Urban Ecology Center. That's where I meet up with Tim Vargo and a few of his colleagues one evening just before sunset. Vargo is manager of research and community science at the Urban Ecology Center. We haul a couple canoes down to the river, and we set off for a little paddle in search of beavers. Before we even push away from the shore, we see another little furry mammal. A mink scurries up a tree where we just launched our canoes.
Oh,
was that a muskrat?
Was that a pet ferret?
No, that was a mink, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it just skipped.
Oh, wow. Cool, mink.
Now we just need a beaver.
Yeah, wow. Ecologists say the return of wildlife is a sign that ecosystems are recovering. It's also a sign that, like people in Milwaukee, beavers are learning to love their local rivers once again. Tim Vargo says the return of animals like minks and beavers to this stretch of the river parallels the city's own attitude toward its waterways.
There's a much longer story here of Milwaukee's relationship with the river. Where we're paddling right now, there were swimming schools up and down this river. There were amusement parks. Ski jumps. In the wintertime, there was a lot of ice skating, and there was something called canoe jousting, where people would stand in canoes and push them together, and you'd have like a big Q-tip kind of thing, and you try to, as you went by your other canoe, or you try to push them into the river.
All right, I can kind of see why that might have gone by the wayside. But what about the rest of it? What happened to all that stuff?
Essentially, the reason the river was such a great place for recreation is one of the founders of Milwaukee built a dam, and it created this really nice area for recreation. the pool behind the dam allowed for all of this. But that same dam, there was a lot of industry and a lot of pollution. So at the same time, people were really enjoying the river and swimming in it. There were swimming schools up and down the river. At the same time, there was also industry polluting the river. And so it didn't take long for the pollution to catch up. And when the river started getting pretty smelly, and once they started investing more, the city started investing more in the lakefront, you kind of had people moving away from the river to the lake. So you had this period of loving the river to a period of completely destroying it. And then probably in the last 20 years, which coincides with the return of some great wildlife, you have people investing in it and loving it again. And trails up and down the river now are really popular, bird watching. But we just had our first swimming race here, swimming in the actual river.
Really?
Which was unheard of maybe 10 years ago. There's a spotted sandpiper over there on the...
Oh, spotted sandpiper? Oh, yeah. What's that? What are those?
Two downy woodpeckers.
Oh, downy woodpeckers. Wow, cool. The sandpipers and downy woodpeckers are cool, but I'm hoping to see a beaver. And not long after that sighting, Maggie Steinhauer, Research and Community Science Coordinator for the Urban Ecology Center, spots something furry swimming along the shoreline near a little burrow into the muddy riverbank.
Swimming over there, under that hanging plants, right against the shoreline, something small.
Oh, it is.
The animal swims over by a floating patch of garbage and driftwood, and just as we get close enough to get a good look, it dives underwater. Beavers can hold their breaths for up to 15 minutes, so we wait around, but don't see it again. Today there are an estimated 10 to 15 million beavers in the U.S., but there were once perhaps hundreds of millions, and Vargo says their dams transformed the landscape.
The amount of engineering they did on our planet is ridiculous. It has been shown recently to clean nitrogen from runoff in farms. Here in the Milwaukee area and other places, yeah, it's estimated that they're just doing a lot of environmental cleanup, a lot of services that we spend a lot of money on.
That's another reason ecologists are happy to see beavers returning to urban areas. Last year, researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee found beavers could substantially reduce flooding in some of the county's most flood-prone areas. Trout fishermen, however, worry too many beaver dams could muck up their fishing streams. But in urban Milwaukee, there's still room for people to share the rivers with a few more beavers. The sun eventually set on our canoe ride, and we got back on shore, while bats snapped up bugs over our heads. But one question remained. Was that really a beaver we saw earlier? I never got a glimpse of that scaly, paddle-like tail, so could it have been a muskrat? I had a camera on the canoe, and later I sent my photos to Christopher Yonke, a biologist at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. He emailed right back. "Muskrats swim lower," he wrote. "Those cute ears and huge head, definitely a beaver." This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, to see a photo of those biologist-certified cute ears. And while you're there, listen to our story on Omar Ibn Said, an enslaved man who wrote his memoirs in Arabic. His story has been adapted into an opera.
I had never heard of Omar, and that's the problem, that Omar's story is kind of quintessential to American life. And it's very important that all of our stories be told so that we come to understand who we are in the present.
Today's stories were produced by Lynn Manigan, Sam Rafelson, and me, with help from Kalyani Saxena. Gabe Bullard and Peter O'Dowd edited the show. Our technical directors are Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. And one more thing. Today, we bid farewell to editor Tinku Ray. Tinku's been an integral part of everything we do at Here and Now and has helped shape this podcast, too. And we'll miss her. Thanks for everything, Tinku, and good luck. And thanks to you for listening. Have a nice weekend. Watch some scary movies for Halloween, maybe, and we'll see you Monday.